time for The Outspoken Cyclist, the weekly conversation about cycles, cyclists, travel, trails, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. WJCU broadcasts and streams The Outspoken Cyclist on-air show at 8 a.m. every Saturday morning. In Northeast Ohio, tune in to 88.7 FM, or worldwide, listen in at wjcu.org. Our weekly podcast is available at the close of the on-air show at outspokencyclist.com, or download it with your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello and welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for April 3rd, 2021. This week, we take a trip east. First, to Worcester, Mass., to meet Lynn Tolman, the president of the Major Taylor Association. Then we'll head down to New York City to speak with journalist, teacher, and urban planning researcher John Sirico. Most of us know who Major Taylor was, and today especially, his life and achievements stand out as being most remarkable. Arguably, he was the first Black athlete to break the color barrier, long before Jackie Robinson. Major Taylor was a cycling phenomenon. When he won the world championship back in 1899, though, it wasn't here in the U.S., his home country. He spent many years in Europe to escape the Jim Crow laws of the day and was revered for his prowess on the bike. Today, the Major Taylor Association in Worcester, Mass. Is dedicated to keeping his legacy alive with programs for schools, rides, and much more. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest this week. How is the East Coast?
Bike season is getting going. We've had some warm days and some not so warm days, but we're rolling.
We're rolling. No pun intended, or maybe. So you are president of the Major Taylor Association. And, you know, when I was doing my due diligence before our conversation, I realized you have such an interesting background just leading up to this particular work that you're doing right now. Tell us a little bit about Lynn Tolman, who she is, what her history is with bicycles and bicycling. And then we'll talk about the Major Taylor Association.
Okay. Well, I'm a journalist by profession. My whole career has been in daily newspapers, first as a reporter and then as an editor. And I'm a cyclist. Like most people, learned to ride a bike as a kid, used a bike to get to my teenage summer job, really got into it with a cycling club here in Worcester, Massachusetts when I was about 25. And just totally got the bug then. I'm a recreational cyclist, not a racer. I would say I am about endurance, not speed. And I'm a roadie. I've done a little bit of mountain biking, but I'm pretty much just a roadie now.
Tell me a little bit about how you got into the work you're doing with the Major Taylor Association. And I know that most of my listeners know who Major Taylor was. We'll get back to him in a moment and his background.
I first learned about Major Taylor from a mention in a book. I think it was actually a book about the Tour de France, although he had nothing to do with the Tour de France. It mentioned he was from Worcester. I was writing the cycling column for the Telegram and Gazette here in Worcester at the time. So I looked him up in the newspaper's library, found some old clips about him. I wrote a column about him. And a few years later, some other local people who stumbled onto his story wanted to put up a statue. They knew I had written about him, and so they brought me into it. And that's how I got involved with this local group that just had this idea, hey, there ought to be a statue. And I have to say, at first, I was not convinced that a chunk of bronze was the best way to bring this story alive. But it's turned out really differently. The sculptor actually read us a quotation that really crystallized our goal, how this could work. And that was that public monuments help shape collective memory. And I think that's really turned out to be true, that the statue, for one, just weaves it right into the fabric of the community, that people recognize the name. at least here in Worcester, and we're still definitely working on making Major Taylor a household name in the rest of the country. You know, it should be a household name like Jackie Robinson. You just say those two words and everybody knows who he was and what he did and the significance of it.
That is true. Give us a little bit of history going back to the beginning. I mean, I've read about him. I've known about him. There is a Major Taylor Club in Ohio. But tell us about the man himself, because he had a very interesting life.
Yeah, the shortest way to say it is the Jackie Robinson of cycling broke the color barrier in his sport. Of course, it was 50 years before Jackie Robinson joined the Brooklyn Dodgers that Major Taylor became a world champion. So really, we should say it the other way around, right?
That
Jackie Robinson was the Major Taylor of baseball. So that's the short story, someone who broke the color barrier in his sport. So we're talking about the turn of the 20th century, 1890s, 1900. He became world champion in 1899. He set numerous speed records, and this was at the height of Jim Crow segregation, violently enforced by lynching in the United States. So he had to fight just to get on the starting line, and he faced all kinds of closed doors and open hostility, and he did it with remarkable dignity. What really struck me about his story, just what a tightrope he had to walk in those days, and the personal qualities that played into that, and the societal forces, how he was able to do that. He really became dominant. He really was the fastest rider on this was track cycling, and he was the first Black athlete to really become an international superstar. He was a rock star. He was huge box office. The promoters loved it because he'd bring in crowds and make a lot of money. He was well paid. He was one of the richest Blacks in America from the money he made from this. At the same time, he was basically hounded out of the United States by all the racist treatment and found refuge primarily in Europe. Based in France and racing all over Europe. He actually resisted going to Europe for years, turned down some very lucrative offers because he was a religious person, churchgoer, devout Baptist, and wasn't going to work on the Sabbath, didn't want to race on Sundays. And a lot of the racing in Europe took place on Sundays. But when he got to be a big enough star after he'd won the world championship, then he could really call the shots, and he was able to negotiate a contract that specified, a European contract that specified no racing on Sundays. So he first went across the Atlantic in 1901 and just proceeded to defeat every European champion. He also had successful tours in Australia, and I think it was for around 5 years, just didn't even race in the United States anymore. So it was an interesting way for a very interesting trajectory.
So let me take a moment to reintroduce you, and then I want to just wrap up a little bit about his background and then move into what you're doing. We're speaking with Lynn Tolman. She is the president of the Major Taylor Association. It's headquartered in Worcester, Mass. I think I said that correctly.
Yes.
Yeah. I know people. I know that that's a big deal for people over there. Don't mess up the name of the city. So he did not, and his life did not end up the way he was during his heyday. As I remember, he had kind of a sad ending to his life. Is that true? Am I making that up?
It is true. Major Taylor retired in 1910 and died in 1932. He actually died a pauper, was buried in an unmarked grave. Once he was out of the headlines and his racing career was over, I mean, then as now, fame was fleeting. He tried to get into the burgeoning automobile business, as many of the cycling people of his day did. He had an automobile tire repair shop. He had lost a big investment in automobile tire innovation that didn't get off the ground. So he, you know, wasn't bringing in the big prize money anymore, the big appearance fees. His marriage became strained. He labored over his autobiography, which was published in 1928. And he was actually selling copies of it out of the trunk of his car on the road on his way to Chicago, which is where he died in 1932. And yeah, he was pretty much forgotten for a good part of the 20th century.
And yet, we are reviving him today. I think he'd be very surprised at what is happening today and what his place is probably going to be if people like you and your organization keep doing what they're doing. So let's talk a little bit about the Major Taylor Association. When was it formed? What does it do? And we'll talk a little bit about who supports it, because it seems, you know, looking over the website, you're getting a lot of support, which is very heartening to me.
Yeah, the Major Taylor Association started in the late 1990s. It was coming up on the centennial of Major Taylor's World Championship in 99. The organization was formed primarily to put up a statue, which we did. It took about 10 years to raise the money. The statue was dedicated in 2008, and the association continues as a way to continue to educate people about Major Taylor's life and legacy. We have a free curriculum guide that teachers and youth groups can download. We keep track of all the tributes to Major Taylor happening around the country, murals going up in different cities. But the place that the legacy has really is really picking up speed is with these Major Taylor cycling clubs, as you mentioned, that have sprouted all across the country. And the first one was in Ohio. That predated our organization. That was in Columbus. Now there's one in Cleveland as well. There are over 60 Major Taylor cycling clubs around the country. And those are really our ambassadors that take this story in whatever ways they decide, because they operate independently of us. They're self-governing. Some of them do work with libraries and schools and youth groups. Some of them just ride. And that works out great, actually, for telling the story. If they're riding with the name Major Taylor or a picture of Major Taylor on their jersey and people take notice, if they're a predominantly Black group that's riding together, people take notice, and that might debunk a stereotype right there that, you know, all Black people don't ride bikes this way, or, you know, don't swim, don't hike, what you name it. So they're really getting the word out there. And then there's all kinds of different events and rides. Cool thing that's happening this year, the Major Taylor Cycling Club of Kansas City is working with Unbound Gravel. It's one of the premier gravel rides in the country, out of Emporia, Kansas. And they have reserved up to 65 free entries, free slots for people that sign up through the Major Taylor Cycling Club of Kansas City. So that's an effort to diversify participation in that event and also bring Major Taylor's story to more people. Then there's smaller events, like there's one in Tulsa coming up on June 18th called the Black Wall Street 100. This year is the 100th anniversary of the Tulsa Race Massacre, when the Black Business District, the Black Wall Street, the Greenwood District it's called, was decimated by a white mob. So this is a 25K, 50K, or 100K ride, and I think they're going to have some Major Taylor sprints too. And our affiliate in Tulsa is helping out with that. It's called the Major Taylor Tulsa Project. So everything from big events to small ones is really getting the name and the word out. There's been some new biographies of Major Taylor. The first one really came out in the 1980s. But there's a more recent one by Michael Cranish. He's still doing author talks. There's one coming up April 20th, virtual, through the Indianapolis Public Library. And I was just looking, and there's still some seats available for that Zoom.
It's funny when you say that, but it is true. Once again, we're speaking with Lynn Tolman. She's the president of the Major Taylor Association out of Worcester, Mass. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back to talk with Lynn about the Major Taylor Association some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. bicycle crash is not an accident. And when you find yourself in a situation that calls for experienced, effective, and positive legal support and advocacy, you can depend on any of North America's independent Bike Law members. Bike Law's cycling attorneys are members of our community committed to the pursuit of cycling safety and justice. For more information about Bike Law, log on to bikelaw.com. They're on your left, protecting your rights. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. We're speaking with Lynn Tolman. She is the president of the Major Taylor Association in Worcester, Mass. I want to take a little bit of our time to talk about these events being planned right now. And I know some of it has to do with the history of Major Taylor, but it seems to me that with all of the issues and the concerns and Black Lives Matter and all of the things that have happened over the last 14 months, that this has, it's sort of a poignant juxtaposition of the Major Taylor revival, if you want to call it that, and the way people are looking at just the way Black and brown people are treated in this country. And now, you know, this sort of assimilation, hopefully, of Black riders into cycling.
Yeah, I think you've really tapped into the zeitgeist here, and the growth that we're seeing in these Major Taylor cycling clubs has really taken off since last year and the murder of George Floyd. I mean, that's reinvigorated Black Lives Matter, and we're seeing it in every aspect of society. So 10, 15 years ago, when the Major Taylor cycling clubs were just starting to pick up, we were thinking, well, tell this story of this one person who broke the color barrier in a sport, and that will serve as an inspiration for the next generation. And now it's really serving as a jumping off point for many more layers of conversation. For example, some of the clubs are involved in their own cities and around the country on topics like, can you hear me making air quotes here, cycling while Black.
Okay.
In other words, how Black cyclists are policed, who gets stopped, who gets arrested, who gets ticketed, and what happens after that. There's a professor at Rutgers named Charles T. Brown, who's compiled a lot of data on that. The Major Taylor Cycling Club of Chicago, I know, has participated in some forums, and there's another group there called Equiticity that works on issues like that. And some of it, as I said, is just also just looking at diversity, who cycles, who's, you know, kind of whose streets, who belongs on the road with infrastructure when you're talking about issues like where do bike lanes get built, what neighborhoods get them, you know, who's at the table for these decisions, and how does that change the table? So these are all kind of things that Major Taylor's story has helped inspire new conversations. The Major Taylor Iron Riders, which is a club out of New York, now has a regular column in a cycling magazine in Velo News called the Major Taylor Journal, and that's bringing a lot of new voices to the fore. Pittsburgh Major Taylor Cycling Club president Shakaya Bailey has had some speaking gigs, like with the League of American Bicyclists recently at their national summit, talking about diversity and inclusion in the sport. One of the conversations that I thought was really interesting was about, it's not that we need to bring more Black people into cycling. It's, you know, that sometimes they're just invisible. Black people are out there cycling, but why aren't they in the quote-unquote organized cycling conversations?
That's an interesting point. I owned a bike shop for many, many, many years, and I was aware of and had Black clients all those years. I was aware of their clubs. I was aware of their riding. I was aware of everything they were doing. What I did see, though, was sort of this segregation that as a club, and they rode beautiful equipment, had fabulous looking jerseys, and when they were on the road, they were impressive. But they didn't seem to mingle with the white clubs, you know, the sort of what you and I might call the elite fancy riders, if you want to call it that. And so you didn't see them riding together unless it was a big organized ride where everybody rode. So I'm kind of wondering whether there'll be some crossover that some people from Major Taylor will ride with other clubs and people from other clubs will ride with the Major Taylor riders. I'd like to see more of that.
I think it's happening. I mean, some of the, like you said, you would see people at big events. The Seagull Century, which is an annual fall event in Maryland, is a big magnet for a lot of the Major Taylor clubs. And the Major Taylor clubs now are doing a lot more networking with each other. They're planning a big ride in Indianapolis for next year, for 2022, things like that. So, but yeah, I think factions of all kinds in cycling has always been an issue. You know, you have the mountain bikers and the roadies, and now you have the gravel and the this and the that. And it's tough. And I see that, this is kind of a tangent, but I see that for women too. When I first started riding with a club, men and women, and I couldn't keep up with all the men, but I didn't feel intimidated, and there were people that I was comfortable riding with. And meanwhile, in my area, or since then, a very large women's group has formed. And now oftentimes at the start of the Sunday rides, the parking lot kind of breaks down that way. All the women stand together over here, and they're like, well, we're going to go this pace, and all the men stand together over there. And maybe one or two of the men will go with the women because they don't want to go that fast. And then it turns into this big joke of like, oh, you have your harem. And it's just kind of...
That's ugly.
It's good and it's bad. And meanwhile, I find myself like wanting to ride with the women's group on a lot of those rides. That's more my pace, more my style. And I got to say, it's it is a different vibe, and I like it just fine. But when I was 25, 30, and I could hang with some of them then, or I don't know, maybe some of them hung back with me to flirt,
Right. That's an interesting point though. I mean, I know there's a big club here in Northeast Ohio, and they have their ABC riders. So you're fast, you're medium, and you're slow riders. And you still tend to see a few women riding A group and a few men riding C group. But for the most part, there is this sort of self-segregation. And I think the bicycle industry has a lot to say about that. They've influenced cycling in a very negative way by focusing on competition as opposed to participation. I think that's changing, but it's very slow. It's like turning the ship around in the Suez Canal. You know, that's what it feels like. It's going to take a long, long time. And it's going to be an ongoing conversation, I think, as all of this starts to fall out, where everybody's watching, I think, the trial in Missouri. Is that where it is? Yes.
Minnesota.
Sorry, the other M group, the Minnesota group. Yes, I have the state wrong, but I think I have the trial correct. Well, Lynn, this has been a fascinating conversation. I'd like you to give my listeners a way to find out more about your organization and about some of the rides you mentioned. I know they're listed on your site. So if you would give them that, I would appreciate it.
Yeah, we're on the web at majortaylorassociation.org. That's all spelled out. And we're on Twitter at majortaylor99, because 1899 was the year of Major Taylor's World Championship. So those are the two places to find us online and see what's happening. Yeah, we welcome riders of all stripes and not just cyclists. You know, initially our best traction was in the cycling world, but the Major Taylor Association itself is not a cycling club. We have all these clubs that we're associated with, but we're more of an educational, informational, history kind of thing. Another thing, oh, I forgot to mention this, is that a Major Taylor Museum is opening later this year here in Worcester.
Oh, I guess that's kind of an important thing we should talk about.
Yeah, so it's in the old courthouse in Worcester, which was empty for many years, and a developer has now turned that building into apartments and has reserved a good amount of space on the first floor for a permanent Major Taylor exhibit, which is going to allow, I think, the story to be told in a lot more depth than we've seen before. So we're hoping that's going to be of course, the nature of public space is changing as we speak with the pandemic and how things will be after that. But we think this space is going to be a really interesting place for people to learn more about Major Taylor.
Do they have a website up yet?
They don't.
Okay. So we'll just keep watching your association, and I imagine you'll make an announcement when it opens.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'll be there with bells on. I also forgot to talk about the George Street Bike Challenge. Another unfortunate effect of the pandemic is that this year, for the second year in a row, we're not doing the George Street Bike Challenge. But this is an uphill time trial here in Worcester on a hill that Major Taylor conquered. That's kind of the living legacy. This event is a hoot. It's a short, wicked, steep street. We can do it as a time trial, one rider at a time, and it's a spectacle. We get riders of all ages, all types of bikes, and it's really a lot of fun. Everyone's a winner just for getting to the top, but we do run the stopwatch, we do clock people, and that's a lot of fun. This is a hill that was a known challenge for cyclists even when Major Taylor moved here as a teenager in the mid-1890s. And he was told any cyclist worth his salt ought to be able to get up that hill. And so he went over to try it. He already had a name for himself, a crowd formed to watch him do it. He wrote that he went up and down twice in quick succession. We don't know his time. And we don't let the riders come down it nowadays. It's a one-way street. So they go up and around the block. The George Street Bike Challenge, we hope we'll be back once this pandemic is behind us.
So it isn't happening this season?
We normally do it in July, and we are not planning on it this year.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's too bad.
It'll be back. The hill will still be there.
That's true.
It's like the Mount Everest for cyclists around here. You know, you got to ride it because it's there.
I totally get it. Absolutely. And, you know, people love those kinds of challenges. It must be a lot of fun, that one. How long is the hill? What's the distance? Do you know?
It's two short blocks. I think the distance is maybe 500 feet.
Oh, so it's really steep.
Yeah, and it goes up almost 100 feet in that distance.
Okay.
So I think the average is 18% grade, but it kicks up to like 24% in the middle. So, yeah, it's a quad buster.
I don't want to ask how many people fall over doing it. I could just, you know, it's sort of one of those things you can visualize. Well, Lynn, thank you so much for talking with me about the Major Taylor Association. If people are interested, I've been speaking with Lynn Tolman. She's the president of the Major Taylor Association in Worcester, Mass., and you can find it at majortaylorassociation.org. Much luck in 2021. Thanks for talking with me.
My pleasure.
All righty. Lynn Tolman is the president of the Major Taylor Association. If you are interested in any of the programs, want to find or start a Major Taylor Club in your area, or learn more about the man and his life, log on to majortaylorassociation.org. So let's take a break, and when we return, we'll speak with urban planning researcher and journalist John Sirico. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks. As we begin to inch our way out of the pandemic and back into what life will begin to look like, I wanted to speak with someone who has a particular interest in cities, both here in North America and in Europe, and how cities are changing in response to the way we work, play, and live. John Sirico focuses specifically on issues of mobility, open space, and sustainability. His articles in Bloomberg's City Labs are of particular interest in these areas, and one in particular titled, In COVID-19 Recovery, London Bets Big on Low Traffic, caught my eye. Hello, John. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week, and thanks for being my guest. How are you?
Thank you so much, Diane. I'm doing great. I'm kind of spring is coming in New York, and that's been a good sign.
It is a good sign. It is a good sign. It's spring is here too. Now it's deer eat all the flowers season.
Yeah.
So I wanted to start with your background. You really have an interesting CV, if you want to call it that. And I really like the work you're doing. I mean, I love urban planning. I like the kinds of things you write about. So give my listeners a little bit of your background, where you grew up, went to school, and the path you've chosen, which is really very pertinent today.
Sure. So I grew up on Long Island in New York, just out of New York City, kind of the original suburbs outside of New York City. My parents are both from New York, from the city itself, and basically, you know, I grew up in that community. And then when I went to school, I went back into the city. The only family member to go back into the city. The rest have stayed in the suburbs. So I went to NYU, went to New York University for undergrad for journalism. Kind of originally intended to be a political journalist. I got my degree in both journalism and political science, and kind of had the dream to be, you know, White House press corps, you know, campaign journalist. But as I got to New York and started to really report in New York, I really fell in love with the city itself. And I fell in love with this concept of how cities handle problems and how cities take on issues and really can't wait to act because, you know, you have to solve the streets because they're about to be overflowed with traffic, or you have to build the housing because you have an affordability crisis. They can't really wait for politics to kind of get in order. And I always fell in love with that. And at that time, Michael Bloomberg was kind of coming to the end of his term. And he had been mayor for 12 years, so I was really interested in his tenure at that time. And then, you know, I kind of stepped away. I graduated from NYU in the early 2010s, you know, and kind of was willing to report on anything. I was just trying to make the rent at that time. So I was, you know, willing to take anything. I was covering a lot of crime and criminal justice for a number of different outlets. I was covering a lot of breaking news, anything that was kind of going on that I could kind of pitch to news outlets. Doing a lot of human interest stories, but basically was a general reporter. Then I kind of signed on to do the 2016 presidential race. And, you know, I still had that kind of inclination to cover politics. So I did the 2016 presidential race mostly for Vice, for the news outlet Vice. And I went to New Hampshire. I went to Washington, D.C. for, you know, for the inauguration. I covered all the rallies. And I realized that I still had this love for cities. I kind of wasn't really interested in these national issues as much. I was more interested in how cities kind of proposed solutions. So basically at that time, I said to my editor, hey, I want to focus more locally on kind of municipal innovation. And we came up with this idea to cover the New York City subway. This was back in 2017. So at that time, the New York City subway was really declining in performance. It had one of the worst on-time rates of any major city's transit systems. So I kind of fell into this rabbit hole. You know, I started covering transportation, did not have any experience covering it. You know, I took the subway every day, but didn't really think about how I got around. Didn't really think about, you know, I always cycled, but I didn't really think about it kind of more than that. And I really fell down this kind of rabbit hole where I fell in love with transportation and urban planning. I realized how integral it was in so many different conversations, whether it's housing, climate change, you know, economic equity, all these kind of issues. And then, you know, kind of made it my beat over the past 5 years. And essentially last year, in September 2019, I went to the United Kingdom to get actually an urban planning degree, you know, as a journalist, which is a pretty rare. I was the only journalist I think they've ever seen in their life there. But, you know, I wanted to get an international perspective. And London was always a city that intrigued me from a transit perspective. So, yeah, kind of changed my role. You know, I continue to be a journalist, but also I research transportation. I research different issues facing cities, and I've kind of tried to blend the two. And that's where I'm kind of at now. And I also teach journalism as well now.
Wow, you don't have enough to do like me. You need more. Yeah. You need more projects. There you go.
Every day is a different day.
It is. Let me take a moment to reintroduce you. We're speaking with John Sirico. He's a journalist, a teacher, an urban planning researcher, which is a little bit different from just straight up urban planning. And we will talk about that. I found him through an article he wrote for Bloomberg, City Lab, I think it was. And it was about the London transportation system and what they were doing to begin to quiet streets and get more bicycles on streets, and about people who hadn't ridden in the past. But we'll get there. We'll get there. So I wanted to talk about some of the changes you've seen since the start of the pandemic. I've been talking about it on the show, and I want to know, New York, of course, is what we look to for a lot of things, both good and bad, by the way. And you were in London. So tell us how things might be changing and whether they're going to stay changed as far as streets and mobility and sustainability goes.
Sure. So, you know, I like, you know, many people interested in obviously this field, when the pandemic lockdown really started to begin in March and April, I started to document how cities were starting to react. And I was seeing it in my own kind of day to day at that time in the United Kingdom. And I think since then, since now we're a year into it, I've come to this kind of conclusion that, of course, cities had to react. They had to kind of, you know, abide by social distancing regulations. Most cities, you cannot walk 6 feet away from each other on a sidewalk because we did dedicate so much street space to cars. So that was kind of the initial dynamic that was fueling a lot of cities. They needed to give more space to people just to simply abide by the laws that were being put into place, right? And about a year in, what I've kind of concluded is that each city has kind of done something very unique, has kind of mastered a specific thing that they're good at. For example, in London, I would say the low traffic neighborhoods is probably the most expansive innovation, and we could talk about them in a little bit, you know, and that's kind of their calling card right now is low traffic neighborhoods. I would say in Paris, it's really these cycle highways that are being built on major thoroughfares in Paris. In New York, I personally think the open restaurants are the biggest kind of innovation that's happened since the pandemic. And I would say in cities around America, it's really the slow streets movement that has really taken off this last year. And I think every single city has a specialty because every city is different. You know, I think with New York, it's a bit harder to do low traffic neighborhoods because we're a grid system. It's harder to do that innovation and really be successful with it, even though there's definitely movement to do that here. You don't really need outdoor dining in Paris because they already had it, right? Paris didn't need to do that as much. But London, it's very hard to do outdoor dining because it's a Victorian city. So it's very, very narrow, the street. It's hard to take over parking space and build outdoor dining in London, which is why I think it never really took off there. Whether they'll last, you know, I'm of the belief right now that people's minds are starting to change. 5 years ago, if you told businesses that the city was going to come and take parking away for anything, businesses were in uproar, and they still react in many kind of occasions like that. But now I'm seeing literally every single day businesses building even bigger outdoor structures and parking spots. So it's a couple of years ago, completely against changing that parking spot outside because that's where customers were parked. And now they're reclaiming it in ways I've never seen before. So attitudes can change really fast. And I think that's really important to note. And I think what we're seeing right now is, of course, another major crisis. It's a paradigm shift like past crises. You know, the 1970s oil crisis led to a bike boom, but also led to a lot of a lot of money taken from public transit revenues because of the fiscal crisis. And then with 2008, we saw the kind of decline of Wall Street as a major kind of, you know, figure temporarily. And then we saw the kind of rise of Silicon Valley, which led to Uber and Waze and all these new apps. So all these crises lead to something. They always lead to kind of lasting patterns. I think the pandemic is perhaps really the greatest disruption we've seen, way more disruptive than the oil crisis in 2008, because it really targeted movement. You know, how it will last, I think it's what remains to be seen. But I'm pretty confident that a lot of people are going to have behaviors that are going to stick around for some time.
Oh, that would be nice. One of the things that concerns me is that for the cities or the areas that needed to lock down or make driving not the way to go, so that you were supposed to stay home and only get outside to either ride a bike or walk or whatever, that they're not really going to look at what they need to do to continue that. And yet we do know that the newer the younger generation, I should say, not newer, but younger generation, may not be so interested in cars, may not be so interested in the suburbs. And so that's something I'm wondering how you're seeing cities reacting to that. And then, of course, we have the whole inequity of and diversity issue of, you know, Black and brown people who may not have a car and need to get to work.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, of course, the COVID getting the kind of label as the great accelerant, the kind of the disruption that accelerated so many trends. You know, remote work was starting to kind of feed more and more into the workplace. And of course, now it's become such a major trend. It's the kind of same here where the younger generations, you know, were moving away from cars. They were moving towards more livable environments, wanted to be in a place where they didn't need a car. And developers were responding. You know, in the past couple of years, you've seen a lot of developments come up that were less car centric because they were responding to the customer base. And with this last year, that accelerated these things. You know, a lot of these plans that were in the works, whether it was in London, whether it was in Paris, whether it was in New York, whether it was around the US and cities in Philadelphia, Cleveland, wherever, these were plans that were being talked about many times. There were always talks of kind of giving parking spots to outdoor, expanding space for outdoor dining. There was always talks about these cycle ways. You know, maybe they were going to be temporary, but COVID gave a kind of reason to be like, let's kind of accelerate them. So these trends existed way before COVID, and we were moving in a direction where we were taking less trips. I mean, if you look at, you know, I was doing some research over the summer for Manchester, the kind of great English city in the north. And we basically were talking about that our trips have kind of declined over the past couple of decades. We don't take as many trips as we used to for a number of different reasons. You know, we might not go to Blockbuster more. Now we just turn on Netflix. We might not go to the grocery store anymore. We just get online delivery. We don't have to move. We might not go to a shopping mall anymore, right? So that was already kind of happening. And I think what's going to be so interesting these next couple of years as we recover is how many of these trips will be changed, what behaviors will stick around, will people continue to be around their neighborhood much more. And that really is going to go to the permanence of, you know, where remote work stands and whether companies decide to go back to an office or whether people now have picked up a behavior where they don't actually, you know, I actually really like doing online delivery. I actually really like e-scootering or taking a bike nearby to the grocery store and not being near my office. A lot of those kind of questions now that I think, you know, are being answered. I think we're seeing the early glimpses of what it could look like, though.
So I want to take another moment to reintroduce you, and then we're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back and talk some more. We're speaking with John Sirico. He is a journalist, consummate journalist, teacher, urban planning researcher, and the conversation is fascinating. So we'll be right back. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I hope you're not just joining me, but if you are, we're speaking with John Sirico. He's a journalist, teacher, and urban planning researcher. He's in New York, although he's been out of the country a lot over the last year when other people weren't traveling, which is kind of interesting. So before the break, we were talking about things that are changing that might stick, others that may not, and watching what cities are doing. So there's a really sort of a barrage of conversation right now about infrastructure. This Build Back Better idea that the Biden administration is starting to really focus on. We have a new Secretary of Transportation, thank goodness. And so do you think that this idea will turn into sustainable transportation changes? I mean, it's kind of a crapshoot. I don't know. What do you think?
So it's interesting that you mentioned that, Diane. I was literally this morning just looking up the new details of the plan that's coming out. And one thing I found that's really fascinating, this proposal that the Biden administration is putting out for, I think it's going to be $2.25 trillion infrastructure. It's one of the first times, I think, in my lifetime where there's more in this bill for transit and intercity rail than there are for roads, which in itself, if you know how the DOT policy works, basically the Department of Transportation at the federal level largely funds roads. That's what its kind of main task has always been. It's been highway expansion. It's been interstate highway maintenance. It's been kind of grants for things like that. But this is really fascinating because now we're at a time now where the DOT is now kind of rethinking its role. And I think there's, you know, having Secretary Pete Buttigieg at the kind of helm now, it does seem like the stars are aligning where the public awareness is increasingly there, the appetite's increasingly there. And now the big question, which always dooms infrastructure bills, is the payment. How are we going to pay for this? And I think that I'll leave that to Biden administration to figure that out. But I think that this is a very different bill than what it would have been under the Obama administration. 10 years ago, I don't think we were talking as much about walking and cycling. I don't think we were talking as much about why public transit is integral for the climate crisis. I don't think we were talking as much about why road building maybe is not the way forward, and maybe we should really think about minimizing road building and improving maybe high-speed rail. I think this would have been a very different bill 10 years ago, and I think that gets to the fact that just the kind of, you know, whether you want to call it the Overton window or the public awareness around this, but I think it has changed. And I think we're seeing that in cities. I think we're seeing that in the kind of public conversation. This is the first time I ever remember an administration talking about equity this much in my lifetime, that's for sure. So I think the paradigm has shifted enough for it could be a very different bill. But again, I don't want to get my hopes up after living through so many infrastructure weeks in my life. So we'll see how it kind of goes. But I think it's a very different bill than it would have been 10 years ago.
Yeah, for sure. I haven't read it. I'm glad to hear that somebody's reading it, because I know these bills can be very onerous in terms of how much depth there is and how much breadth there is and how many, you know, we're going to add this in and pull this out and all of that. So one of the things that I really found interesting, and we're going to tell listeners how they can subscribe to your newsletter and to find out what you're doing, is you're talking about, so you have a solutions corner. So that your current newsletter, Journalism and Urbanism, your website's really easy. And so I think people will enjoy going through it and seeing. So I want to talk about some of the solutions you've seen in other parts of either this country, or I think there were some in Montreal, and whether you think these solutions are things that cities who aren't doing things right now, but can look to and maybe make work for them. So what kinds of solutions are you seeing that are getting people out of cars, finding ways to make transportation more equitable, especially for people who cannot afford a car?
Yeah, I think, you know, the kind of talk around best practice, you know, there's different solutions that are going to work for different cities. And I think that kind of gets to the point I was talking about how each city has kind of specialized in something, because every single city is different. I think there's a reason why the slow streets have really picked up in the United States, because, you know, we're largely car dependent cities. These cities were built in the advent of the automobile, right? So the slow streets is kind of the beginning. I think like that's the least we could be doing is kind of slowing down streets. But it's kind of a start. It's a start to rethink of how streets can be used. But I think it kind of gets, it's pretty telling to me of where kind of street life and what we think about the streets is in the U.S., which I think is at a kind of preliminary, starting to get a bit more intermediate and advanced stage. You know, there's cities that are leading the way with cycling. There's cities that kind of are doing really good bus rapid transit right now. I know Indianapolis, I've been following their kind of bus rapid transit. But we're getting the slow streets. I wasn't surprised that it's taken off so much, because it's kind of just the beginning of what streets could be for cities. So, you know, a lot of it depends on what the city's like. I think to me, the initiatives that have gotten the most kind of that are going to have the most permanence are the ones that have the most parties kind of on board here. You know, and ones that kind of come to mind are the open restaurants in New York, which have been scaled the most, particularly because everyone likes them. The restaurant owners have new space. I've seen people in cars not even complain about the parking because they just want to sit at the restaurant, which is kind of incredible to not see a car owner yell that there's less parking. And residents like them because it adds new street life kind of in street energy. But then also one initiative I was covering in London was this initiative called School Streets, which essentially you shut down the streets in front of schools to through traffic just when kids get out of school in the morning and evening rushes or school runs. And this was a proposal that has largely faced no opposition, because the kind of the premise is very universally loved. It's like, we want to keep kids safe. We don't want pollution in front of schools. And, you know, maybe you'll get it, maybe you'll start walking and cycling as a result. So I think these proposals that have community buy-in and have buy-in from also from businesses and also from, you know, even the car owners to some extent. What was so interesting about the school streets is that I would hear from residents who had a car parked on the street, lived in front of the school, And they thought it was lovely that the kids could have this time because they weren't losing much. They lost maybe a half an hour. They lost maybe an hour or so of their time, but they could leave, but they had to go 5 miles per hour. It's kind of like a slow street. So I think these kind of community buy-in, any proposal that has these kind of larger, support that doesn't feel like it's coming from a unitary party or it's coming from a lacked community engagement, which, bike lanes can often get this criticism that they're coming from, they don't represent the neighborhood. Getting at the equity point you brought up before, I think going forward, we're really going to need that community buy-in. And with the slow streets, you'll see them stick around in cities where there's a ton of buy-in, where folks right now, I have a couple open streets near me, the ones that are really successful, I don't think you'll ever be able to give that space back to cars because the neighbors have taken to it so much. So I think that to me cuts across cities. That cuts across what your city is like. Is that kind of community buy-in and kind of universal support. But it takes a certain type of planning and vision to make that happen.
At one point, you had a really interesting transportation czar, Jeanette Sadiq Khan, and she got tons of pushback as she started doing the things she's doing. So apparently time helps to change that too. Now, the times we are living in also is changing that. But it seems like if something is put in place, even if there's pushback at the start, that maybe people start to get used to the idea.
And behaviors change, right?
That's true.
And behaviors change. I mean, what was so interesting about Sadiq Khan, and I remember when I was growing up and she proposed pedestrianizing Times Square and there was so much backlash at the time. And how could you pedestrianize Times Square? And now you can't even imagine that ever going back, and can never imagine walking through a really busy Times Square. Of course, perceptions change, visions change. Now we're at a time where so much is happening in different cities where it feels like things are moving along and it's kind of figuring out what is the pace that each city is going to take of how to do certain things. Like Paris is moving extremely fast because they have a mayor who's quite visionary on those issues. But that's not the case in cities everywhere. And one kind of main criticism the mayor in New York here has gotten, Bill de Blasio, is that he's not as fast on these issues. And I think the main criticism towards him is that it feels like other cities are moving and he's kind of still taking a very cautious approach. So I think that disparity between how fast we think things are moving and how fast government kind of responds will always be the source of contention. But what's been fascinating this last year is that just seeing behaviors change has been so incredible. My dad, who hasn't biked in about 40 years, was seeing all of his neighbors bike because of the lockdown. Now he has a bike and now he's cycling a lot more. And I cycled with him for the first time since I was a kid a couple months ago. And it's the same with my own family members, them seeing, you could have these kind of interventions and not the whole world breaks down. You could have these things happen. And actually, the world is still okay. It might be a bit better when you leave it. This last year being such a sudden shift in behavior change, that to me is almost kind of more just as engaging, compelling as doing these massive projects like Times Square.
So I have two more things I want to talk about. One is, what are you working on now and projects going into, say, the next 12 to 24 months?
Sure. So what I'm working on now, so every single month I write a story for Bloomberg City Lab. So I'm a regular contributor to them. Right now I'm writing about we have a mayoral race this year. So I'm writing a story about where the candidates fall on these issues. What are their thoughts for walking and cycling and transportation? Aside from that, I teach at NYU and I'm teaching basically a course on how to report on cities, teaching prospective journalists how to write about urban planning, how to write about these issues, which has been a lot of fun and a ton of engagement from students, which has been really, I think this year, after this last year, which got so many more people thinking about parks, got so many more people thinking about how they get around, that's certainly boosted the engagement. And aside from all that, I'm also, I'm a research fellow at Center for an Urban Future, which is a think tank here in New York. Been working with them kind of off and on for a number of years now. And we're writing a lot of reports about how the city will recover economically. How can we get more social infrastructure that can help the city? How can we get kind of more economic opportunities spread out from outside and kind of the peripheries of the city? So that's kind of my main focus. I would say it's on the recovery now, and how cities can kind of bounce back.
So there is one more area before I let listeners find out how to find out more about you. Mm. And that is the changing role of urban planning. I see it is shifting. And some of the people I've spoken with over the past few years, Dr. Tab Combs, Mr. Strong Towns, Chuck Marone, Jeff Speck, they have a different perspective on urban planning than it's always been. It is no longer this sort of civil engineer perspective. Yeah. What are you seeing?
I would say absolutely. I think, I noticed that going back to get a planning degree, I was in class with architects and designers and engineers, and that was definitely represented. But it was way different. You know, this is not urban planners that were kind of practiced in the, you know, transportation planning for years was how do we get as many cars down the road as possible, as fast as possible? That's dominated transportation planning. Now it's not as much. You know, now transportation planners and urban planners are kind of studying different texts. They're not reading about Robert Moses, maybe they're read or about kind of the kind of great highways and how, you know, we can build around these roads. It's more so talking about how do we get walking and cycling? How do we build more livable neighborhoods? How do we get community? You know, this conversation about equity is something that's definitely being pushed. I heard it more from students than I did from professors, which was incredible. Planners no longer feeling like it is just, this is the only profession you go in is just planning. You know, it's what I think is really exciting about transportation right now and about urban planning is that you can kind of take that degree and go a lot of different directions. You can go into government, of course, you can go into transportation, you can work for a transit authority, but you could also work for a new startup, or you could work for an advocacy group, or you could work for, you know, new e-bike companies or new e-scooter companies. Just like the diversity of the landscape to me is so kind of vast now, which I think is exciting. And it's not so much kind of cut and dry as much as it used to. You know, I went in there, obviously, I never thought I was going to become an urban planner. I knew I was going to stay in journalism and research because I thought that's where my skills were best suited. And it wasn't seen as a crazy thing. It wasn't, you know, I was kind of accepted pretty quickly as like, he writes about these issues and he's going to broadcast them to the public. That was kind of seen as an urban planner's kind of more role now of being kind of in the public, doing this kind of work that could really change cities. And I think it's way less kind of engineer focused than it used to be, but that's still a part of it. That's not gone. It's just way more diverse now.
Right. Not everybody's designing parking structures and bridges. Right.
No. Right. Oh, yeah. I don't think any of my classmates wants to be doing that. They're more so doing e-bikes and, you know, micromobility really seems to be the big thing, getting into these kind of micromobility companies and curb management. How do we do flexible online deliveries? How do we incentivize against the car? How do we incentivize, you know, streetscapes to be much more livable? That seems to be the main focus of my classmates and also of myself, of course.
Wow, so interesting. I could do this all day, but I know you have other things and I have other things, and it's just been a pleasure to talk with you. We've been speaking with John Sirico. He lives in New York, of course, because that's where it's happening. He's a journalist, a teacher, and urban planning researcher. John, tell my listeners how they can find out more about your work and subscribe to your newsletter if they're interested.
Sure. So Journalism and Urbanism, which is a newsletter I do every single month, can be found on Substack. If you go on Substack and, you know, search Journalism and Urbanism, or go to my website, johnsirico.com, it has all the links. I would love for you all to follow, and so we can continue this conversation.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing your expertise and your information with me, and I hope we get to talk again. Have a great 2021, and get back outside and go ride your bike.
Thank you, Diane. Have a great one.
Okay. John Sirico joined me from his home in New York City. For more information about John, to subscribe to his newsletter, Journalism and Urbanism, or read some of his past articles, you can log on to johnsirico.com. My thanks to John and to Lynn Tolman from the Major Taylor Association. Next week, we'll be meeting frame builder Max Pratt from Providence, Rhode Island. Remember that you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can leave a comment on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. You can also follow us on Instagram at OutspokenCyclist, although I usually just post pictures of our dog, Ella. You can subscribe to the podcast on most podcast platforms, and please rate the show, too. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great week. Remember to stay safe, stay well, and if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show, and we welcome your thoughts and comments. We'll be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and most other podcast apps and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.